This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's a top national security concern before the U.S. and its allies how to counter terrorist groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram, how best to defeat these violent extremists, not just on the battlefield, but in the minds of potential recruits. It's a question our guest today has long wrestled with as a scholar and now member of Secretary of State John Kerry's policy team. We're talking this hour with Haroon Ulam, a diplomat with expertise in what's called public diplomacy, which basically means all efforts aimed at making terrorism less attractive to those who might be tempted to sign up. Mr. Ulam is in New Hampshire to give a talk tonight before the World Affairs Council called Understanding Islamic Parties, Political Violence and Extremism from ISIS to Pakistan. For more information on his presentation, you can go to our website, nhpr.org, and you can join us now with your questions and thoughts about how the U.S. and the West are going about this and whether you think it's being done the right way. Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Haroon Ulam, welcome to New Hampshire. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, definitions, please. We here in America just can't seem to agree on all the terms for especially that one terrorist group that's creating so much turmoil. ISIS, ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, the self-styled Islamic State, Daesh, I think John Kerry used them a couple months ago. What name do you use?
I tend to use Daesh because they hate that word. They hate that word because it's almost like it's a nickname that they don't like. They sort of, you know, they curl up and sort of, you know, oftentimes on social media they'll say, don't call us that, because Daesh is like it's a nickname that no one wants. It means like the losing horse in traditional Arabic. But oftentimes you'll hear in the media ISIL or ISIS. Part of the reason, I think, is that we're trying to get away from using the Islamic State, because that plays into what they want. They want it to be an ideological war. They want it to be about Islam, and we don't want to give them that legitimacy, because they're nothing that represents, as the president said, they're not Islamic, nor are they a state.
So that's why reporters and sometimes members of the administration call it the so-called Islamic State or the self-styled Islamic State.
That's right.
Why don't more of them use that Daesh?
Well, I think it's a foreign-sounding term, so I think a lot of people, it's a little bit awkward using it. And so people, it's just easy to say ISIL or ISIS. Yeah. It just kind of rolls off the tongue. But I, you know, for me and for, I think, others that work in this sphere, you know, we want to sort of, our goal is to do counter narratives. Our goal is to take on the extremists, and we want to use a term that makes them rile.
Well, and so how do you talk about what the issue really is here? We talked about the name of the group, ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call it. President Obama came under some criticism a few weeks back for not using the word, Haroon, Islamic in his summit on countering violent extremism. So how do you talk about that? What is the U.S. combating here? How would you fill in that blank?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's extremists in Islam. There's a virulent strain. We know that for sure. I think that the president, the secretary, their idea was that, look, extremism comes in all forms, in all religions, and we've had history in other religions and other places, and we don't want to play into their narrative. They want to make this a religious war. They want to make this an ideological war. They want to make this a clash of civilizations. they're essentially criminals cloaking themselves in sort of religious language. And so a lot of times it's clear, yes, there's an extremist strain within Islam, and these people are using it. They're almost like, I think of them as gangs. And they're using religious rhetoric because that's the fastest way to power. That's the fastest way to recruit people. But, you know, we don't want to sort of fall into, you know, into their narrative. So I think part of it is sort of taking a step back and thinking about, how do we take them on? How do we undercut their rhetoric? And I think the best way to undercut the rhetoric is to call them for what they are: violent extremists and criminals.
What do you do about the Islamic part of it, though, Haroon? You know, while Muslim groups in America said they appreciated not being lumped with this terrorist organization, there were some in the national security field who said, look, by not specifically defining the threat, you look mushy at a time when you need to look strong.
Well, you know, I think we've been very strong in terms of calling them out for what they are. And, you know, what I focus on is, what are we doing day by day? How are we taking them on? How are we undercutting their rhetoric? You know, Daesh or ISIL, they're putting out 60,000 plus pieces of social media a day. You know, that's an enormous amount of content. And there's young people all around the world, disaffected youth, people that I've met and worked with all over around the world, in the Middle East and South Asia, even here in North America. And so what we're trying to do is, how do you undercut that rhetoric? How do you bring out key influencers, third parties, people in the communities that can speak up, that can say, look, what they're turning the sort of Club Med atmosphere, this lifestyle they're painting, is not true. And this is why, if you have, you know, you want to go abroad to do something, here's an alternative pathway. Here are positive role models.
Well, and that's really interesting. And I definitely want to talk to you about the message and who delivers that message, because, you know, maybe coming from certain individuals, it's more powerful than coming from others. But you've looked at these 60,000 plus items on social media a day. That's enormous. What does that look like? What do they say? What are sort of the promises or the image that's painted that would attract people, especially young men, to this cause?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, they're painting a lifestyle. So, you know, it's almost like, think of it as a visual offensive. They're showing that, look, we have this utopia. Come here. You can be – anybody can be a citizen. You can get married. You can have a family. We don't have governance issues. There's no corruption. So they're painting this sort of utopia for young people. And some of these disaffected young people, they have grievances, they see things going on in the Middle East, and they think, okay, here, this is my chance to be part of the hero journey. This is my adventure. You know, oftentimes, you know, these kids are watching movies or playing video games, and for them, this is a real life way where they have a sense of purpose and adventure. And so they end up seeing some of these messages. Oftentimes, they're very sophisticated on social media. They're using SoundCloud. They're using Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, they have what we call fanboys. And so they have a very active, smaller group, but very active core group that's spreading the message. And part of this information war is that perception becomes reality. And they're very good at branding.
What does fanboy mean?
Fanboys are just supporters. So this is like their supporters, groupies. You know, it's just people that, you know, people from around the world that are supporting the core group of sort of foreign fighters and those that are in Syria and Iraq.
So would they physically go to other countries and say, hey, this is great, check it out? Or would they do that on social media or both?
It's all on social media. Most of it's on social media. That's how they do their recruitment. And these fanboys are in different countries, but they're supporters. They're retweeting their messages. They're liking their things on Facebook. They are, you know, putting together testimonial videos. Oftentimes you'll see things on Instagram where they'll put ISIS flags, and they'll just put the flags near iconic landmarks in, you know, Europe or even here in the U.S., and they'll say ISIS is here. And that's part
of— Wow, that's creepy.
Yeah, it is creepy, and that's part of their, you know, their this campaign, because they're, again, they're very good at sort of projecting, and they're very good in terms of, you know, branding themselves.
So it's sort of something any—and I hate to stereotype one group of people, but especially young men— you know, sort of a way to kick the establishment in the teeth and, you know, be a hero and carry a big gun.
Right. Yeah. It's like playing Call of Duty or, you know, Assassin's Creed. You know, it's for thinking for young people, it's this hero journey. And also women. You find a lot of young women. If you've seen in the news recently, you had the three young women from the United Kingdom. You had two women in Colorado not too long ago. So there's also – they are trying to attract women because they're saying, look, you can come here. You can have a family. You can get married. You can work. And they're painting this idea that it's not just for men, but it's a lifestyle for families. And so you find a lot of young people from all around the world getting attracted to that.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more, if you could, Haroon, about the messaging for young women, because a lot of the attention has been on young men. But you're right. There have been these isolated incidents of young women, teenage girls, really, being attracted to this.
Yeah, they're giving them a sense of also purpose, because a lot of these women may feel disillusioned in their communities. They may feel that it's very patriarchal. And the way Daesh is saying that you can come to our communities, you can wear whatever you want to wear in terms of the Muslim garb. You'll be free of any stereotyping, any form of discrimination.
So it's not like Al-Qaeda when it comes to
exactly. You
women.
You won't feel any Islamophobia. So what they're trying to say is that come here, you can, reach your full potential, and that, you have all these amenities, you have all these things that you don't find in other places. Now, again, majority of that is untrue. It's inaccurate. People go there. They find, that there's no jobs, there's no utopia, there's corruption, but it's too late.
Well, when you say come here, where is here?
So most of it's just to come to Syria. A lot of people, a lot of the foreign fighters, a lot of the young women, they'll come into, they'll fly into Turkey, and then they'll get taken across the border to Syria. Some will go to Iraq, but majority of them are going to Syria.
And like major cities in Syria or major ISIS outposts in Syria? Or
exactly. They'll go to cities like Raqqa. We'll spend a lot of time there.
Is that the capital? Because I keep hearing about
yes,
that.
Yes,
that's the capital of the so-called self-styled Islamic
that's
State.
Right. That's right. That's kind of their home base. A lot of people will go there. There's some sort of outlying towns that they'll go to. But part of it is that, they're trying to – if you look at the map, what Daesh has done is that they've sort of – the territory they've taken, it's linear in the sense that, they're trying to sort of build – on the outskirts, sort of guerrilla armies, and they have these little outposts around Raqqa. Obviously, they've taken Mosul. Mosul's the anchor in Iraq, and that's where a lot of these young people are going.
It's hard to imagine that Raqqa or Mosul are utopia. I mean, it seems like, given that there's been war there for so long, that there wouldn't be, jobs and wonderful places to live and raise a family. I mean, my goodness.
Absolutely. And this is part of the counter campaign, the counter narrative, is to show how life really is on the ground, to show testimonials. And we don't see enough of that content coming out. But what we do see is these YouTube videos and these sort of tour guides taking us around. It's almost like watching a vacation, a tourist video. They're marketing themselves and they're showing this amazing place that doesn't exist. But there's not
enough.
Come
on, really?
Absolutely. And, you watch it and you're thinking, is this the same city that we know of? And exactly as you think intuitively, that's not how things are on the ground. But a lot of young people see these glossy videos that are in HD that show this utopia and they think, boy, that's where I want to go. I think things haven't gone the way that they should have. We have some grievances about what Syria should look like and Iraq should look like. And I want to be part of that story.
So they can be sort of the building of a new great society, like the American Revolution, the founders of this country and other, the founders of Israel or other nations. They can get
on the
ground floor.
Exactly. They just say, look, we have territory. We're the ones doing things there on the ground in the Middle East. Come join us.
All right. Coming up after a short break, Haroon, we will definitely talk about this recruitment drive that you've been looking at and then how the U.S. and other nations counter that narrative. Lots of stuff to dive into after a short break. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Haroon Ullah is with us, scholar and senior advisor at the State Department, working with Secretary Kerry on what's called public diplomacy, countering the narrative made by violent extremist groups like ISIS or ISIL, call it what you will. Haroon Ullah's books include The Battle, The Bargain from the Bazaar, A Family's Day of Reckoning in Lahore. It's about a family dealing with efforts to recruit one of the sons in the family toward violent extremism. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477, as we talk about the narrative that some of these terrorist groups are putting out there and how the United States and others might counter that narrative. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Haroon, I know just before the break I said I want to talk to you about what you're doing, what others need to do to counter this narrative. But just a couple more questions on the messaging that's being put out there by the Islamic State, Daesh. NPR crunched some numbers recently on recruits to this group. 20,000 foreign fighters who've traveled to Syria, including 3,400 from the U.S. and Western Europe. Who are these recruits? What motivates them to do this?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we spend a lot of our time trying to look at that.
Because then you can target your efforts.
And it has dire consequences. I mean, I'll say one thing. I mean, one thing that we see that cuts across is that they're obviously disaffected youth. They're oftentimes they're motivated by identity grievances. And so, you know, it's not necessarily ideological, but it's identity grievances that they have.
What does that mean?
I think that means that they're coming of age issues. They see that they have grievances potentially. Like they look at out in the Muslim world and they see the Middle East and they say, hey, there's a war. The West is having this war out there and we don't agree with it and we don't like the outcomes. We want to be part of the change to what's going on in Iraq and Syria. The other thing I would say is that we find this phenomenon of what I call the thin middle class. That you find a lot of young people that are in this what I call thin middle class that have had a great education, oftentimes have gone to university, maybe they've worked, but they're the ones that oftentimes are recruited. It's not necessarily – a lot of people have the idea that, oh, these kids are from the slums or they're from the poor parts of town. That's not the case. A lot of them are well-to-do, have had a good education, but again, they're disaffected. They don't have a support network. They're sitting somewhere in their basement and they're reading a lot of this stuff online and they sort of, you know, they're on these chat forums and then they sort of get – they see a lot of these pictures. They see, you know, what's going on there and they think, hey, why am I part of something? I'm 16 years old. I want a sense of adventure. I'm looking for a sense of purpose and this seems like the perfect opportunity for me to materialize that.
Well, in Europe, you also hear about unemployment. So someone may have a decent – family life and a good education, but then, you know, with unemployment rates of, you know, 15, 20, 25% in Spain, you're right. Young people have no real purpose in life. But in the United States, unemployment's, you know, 5.5%. So just give us a little contrast there, if you could, Haroon.
Yeah, I think in Europe, you know, the interesting thing is that because they've struggled a lot with integration, they have a lot of these sort of diaspora communities that have become sort of you know, marginalized. And so there's a lot of grievances that come out of there.
Like we heard about in France.
Exactly, like in France, North Africa and other places. In the U.S., it's different. I think that there's obviously it's a thin middle class phenomenon. I think that drives a lot of this. There's, you know, maybe 200 or so young people that have got recruited or get sent. Others, there's many others that have been stopped before they actually leave. But a lot of them, again, we find are, you know, accessing things online. Their parents don't know. Their families don't know. Oftentimes when their families find out, they're shocked that they're even accessing this stuff online. And so part of it is raising awareness, getting community leaders with law enforcement, because really this has to be a community effort.
That was what the summit was all about, too. It was interesting to me, not just calling in sort of big global players, but also local leaders, because they're probably the front line of, you know, catching someone who maybe is doing things they shouldn't.
Absolutely. I mean, and I thought, you know, Boston was one of the cities that was, you know, one of the model cities with best practices. And this is getting faith-based leaders, community leaders, civic society activists, local youth leaders on board, because this is really has to be a community effort. They have to look at where is there somebody that's at risk? How do we identify that person? How do we provide a support network in the communities? You have often pastors or faith-based leaders that see somebody in their congregation. How do you provide them with a social work aspect so that they can actually deal with some of these young people? Because you can't just say, no, don't do this. You have to say,
not enough.
You know, it's not just what you're against, but you have to show them what you're for. You have to show those positive alternative narratives.
Well, was Boston chosen because of the marathon bombing?
Boston, yeah. Boston was chosen because of Marathon Bonnie and how they responded. You know, that's the emblematic. You know, I think of myself as a sort of a Boston native in many ways and sort of the Boston strong. So people saw how Boston community came together, how the leaders came together from the different communities and how they dealt with it. And that was part of a best practice going forward.
So best practice, not just coming together, Boston strong, T-shirts, you know, signs around town, but reaching out to possibly, you know, youth who have these feelings that you talk about?
Absolutely. It was reaching out to a lot of the faith-based communities, a lot of the Muslim youth, particularly in Boston, getting sort of youth groups involved, working with law enforcement. Law enforcement's talking to parents, doing workshops on, here, here's how you could spot something. Here's the measures you could take to sort of make sure that your children and protect your families. That sort of work, a lot of sort of groundwork, a lot of things that are still taking place. That's what we met with in terms of a best practice.
Wow. Okay. Let's take some calls, Haroon, and then a lot more questions for you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're talking about countering the narrative from violent extremists, possibly countering their recruitment efforts to conduct violence through groups like the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram. We're mostly talking about Islamic State today on The Exchange. 1-800-892-6477. Eric's calling from Penacook. Hi, Eric. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello. First of all, thank you for taking my call. I'm actually referring back to something that the guest talked about earlier in describing the kind of utopia. I think you used the word, the term Club Med for the way they describe this. Was there any element of it kind of working against them as far as people going over there and realizing, wow, this isn't what the brochure said? Any disillusionment in that process?
So sort of people who've been disillusioned by that scam, if we can call it that, Eric, and then posting, yeah, sharing that it's not all it was cracked up to be. Yeah, great question. Haroon?
Yeah, great point, Eric, and thanks for that. Absolutely. So we find a lot of people that go there, they realize they're disillusioned. You know, we have so many stories of foreign fighters that are recruited, and they end up being janitors, they end up taking sort of these very menial jobs. The problem is that once they go there, it's very difficult to say, what do they do next? Because oftentimes, for them to come back, there's some legal issues that they will face. It's not clear where they can go back and how they can go back. A lot of them are sort of become indentured when they go there. So it's almost too late when they get there. But absolutely, we found a number of stories, for example, in Denmark, where they had about 16 of these foreign fighters that returned. And we see the stories of disillusionment, of corruption, of the lack of governance, how it's kind of like the wild, wild west. And they realize, but at that point, it's too late.
Well, and here's an article that I just came across this morning from Slate that talks about that. It says there have been some signs, too, that foreign jihadists are growing disillusioned. So these are people coming in from outside, with activists in a couple Syrian provinces, including Raqqa, describing instances in which foreigners have sought local help to escape across the border to Turkey. The bodies of between 30 and 40 men, many of whom appeared to be Asian, were found last month in Raqqa. They were thought to be the remains of a group of jihadist fighters who tried to flee but were caught. And the article goes on to say that Islamic State is imposing new restrictions on travel in and out of the areas that it controls, partly because of this reason, it sounds like, Haroon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see some of the internal divisions that are coming up, the fraying. As I said, young people that are going there realize this is not cracked up to what it is, and they're not getting the fulfillment of what they thought they would. And, you know, these divisions were inevitably going to happen. But we have to do, I think, a better job of exploiting that, of amplifying that, of showing what life really like is on the ground. You know, I think one is too many if they're getting recruited to go abroad, especially Americans. And so part of it is how we have to really double down on increasing that content, getting third parties, raising awareness in our communities, among parents and families, because this is going to take a group effort.
All right, let's take another call. And Trish is calling from Temple. Hi, Trisha. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Listening, I have not heard any reference to the substantive context of the U.S. and Western campaigns in the Middle East and increasing violence that we're imposing. You know, it's from, say, 2003 with our invasion of Iraq, you know, Syria, Libya, even Afghanistan, as far as increasing violence and the widening swath of suffering and despair that our policies have caused And I wonder if there a change in Western policy as a strategy for counteracting terrorism is something that's ever discussed, that aspect of it.
Tricia, it's a great point. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Haroon, and
yeah,
another follow-up.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. Thanks for the question. You know, absolutely, we have to think about the larger context in the Middle East. You have to think about the histories in Iraq and Syria. And you have to think about, where people are, what's happened in terms of this generation that's seen a lot of violence. And what I try to focus on and what we're trying to focus on is the young people that are there. How do we provide those opportunities? And I think as we have pulled out of Iraq and it's Iraqi-led and helped them in terms of reconstruction and sort of giving youth more opportunities for entrepreneurship and innovation. But it takes a long time. I mean, as you're rebuilding schools, as you're rebuilding infrastructure, that takes a long time. And I think that's what we've been trying to focus on, is to try to give those young people this opportunity. Now, at the same time that you're doing that long-range effort, you have these violent extremists that have tried to fill the void. And let's not mistake ourselves. These violent extremists that have come up that are using very ghastly and sort of, kind of horrific methods, shock and awe methods in terms of, dealing with young people. And we've seen what they've done on social media. Their purpose is to sort of to not give young people that positive alternative narrative. They don't want to sort of have young people getting jobs and going to school. They want to shut those down. And they have a certain, you think of them as like a business. And the way they make money is by sort of controlling and centralizing power. So I absolutely think that we have to think about the larger context. I think that's what, if you see the president's policy in terms of Iraq and Syria, I think you see a lot of that in terms of supporting efforts on the ground for the community themselves to sort of define their future.
Well, two follow-ups from Tricia's point that I was thinking of, Haroon. I remember back when the U.S. was heading into war with Afghanistan, a war that a lot of people supported after 9/11. Anti-war groups, though, at the time said, you're just going to radicalize more young Islamic men to carry out more attacks. Then as the U.S. was starting to think about getting into Iraq in 2003, I think it was, the same thing. Some people said, this is just going to make it worse. You're just going to anger more people and turn more of them against the United States. That seems to be part of the point that Tricia's making. Were they right?
I spent a lot of time in South Asia, almost 8 years living in a lot of times in the tribal regions. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, we went in for certain reasons. We went into Iraq for certain reasons in terms of trying to remove, remove Saddam Hussein and sort of what we saw there. And the goal, what I see is what we did is we tried to, on the ground, we tried to build infrastructure. We tried to work with the cities in terms of, we can't forget the kind of oppression that people were living under there, that kind of day-to-day existence they had there. Young women didn't have the chance to go to school. That's a part of Iraq we don't see now in terms of
Afghanistan.
What we see in Iraq and then Afghanistan, obviously, is a much longer sort of time horizon in terms of what we've done there. But both in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think that the goal now is how do we provide young people with those opportunities, undercut the sort of the narrative of the violent extremists. And it's always difficult. Like, it's always difficult when you look back at how this is created. It's sort of it's difficult to look at causation. But I think our goal has been to intervene only when necessary and when it's sort of it's just in terms of where we find those atrocities happening. But then also, how do we help them rebuild?
Well, and okay, so there's the history, and we can interpret it however we want. But also to Tricia's point, and I had this thought too, when you say, Haroon, we need to double down on countering the message from these violent groups. Absolutely. But I do wonder if the message comes from the United States, is your average disaffected youth in Pakistan or France or wherever going to say, yeah, right, I'm going to listen to the United States?
That's a great point.
Look at what they've done.
Yes, that's a great point. And I think oftentimes we're not the best messenger. You have to find third parties. You have to find what I say, key influencers. You have to be able to mobilize that network. So
who is that?
Those are, people, pop icons. Those are sports icons. Those are, what young people listen to, people that, musicians, that is community leaders, faith-based leaders, activists, this actors, actresses. I mean, so we have to think broader in terms of that world of what young people are listening to and getting them involved, because this is not just something, it's a narrow sphere. As you said, U.S. government, you know, people may not read that tweet or read that, you know, see
or
that
they
video.
Read it and they go, uh-huh.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of broaden the aperture and get young people to, you know, that want to mobilize these third parties. And to me, that's critical.
So here you are, Haroon, and that's the idea, you know, mobilizing someone that folks will listen to, that would-be recruits, young men or women will listen to. So let's say you identify someone, a very popular, I don't know, TV star in the Middle East. How do you approach that person? What do you say to that person? You know, help us out?
Yeah. I mean, and oftentimes it's not too difficult. They recognize what's going on. They themselves want to participate. So part of it is just sort of galvanizing them, helping them, supporting them, maybe amplifying, giving them a platform. You know, oftentimes they already want to be involved. They see the damage. They see the carnage going on. They're horrified when they watch these videos of young people being burned alive or being, you know, their heads being cut off. I mean, we all know the tragedy with James Foley, who's from this area, you know, and I had met him and, you know, a while back. And so you meet young people that are doing heroic work, humanitarian, as journalists, people that are going there to try to help those communities. So when they see this barbaric attitude, they want to help. They just are looking for an avenue.
So you approach them, you say, help us out, and more times than not, they say, yeah,
absolutely.
Love to help you out.
They're saying, help us with content or help us with a platform. Where can you connect us to somebody so that we can, you know, broaden our message? Oftentimes it may be, providing sort of capacity building, you know, in terms of what I call tech camps. So, you know, a lot of young people, they have such great ideas, but they don't see themselves as content producers. So how do you show them how to, you know, we take it as sort of because we're so used to social media, but not everybody knows, you know, how do you start a campaign on Facebook or Twitter or sort of Facebook 101? Part of it is giving them those skills. And then they're able to tell their own story. Then they're able to have a microphone. And oftentimes on social media, that's all that young people need.
Can you give us a sense of what those stories sound like? It doesn't need to be a, you know, an absolute 100% true, for instance, but just sort of one of the success stories where you did reach out to one of these third parties and he or she did create a pretty compelling message, a counter message.
Yeah. You know, I would say one of the great, you know, sort of these young people are creating positive role models. I think of this young man named Suleiman Bakit, who's from Jordan. He was here on an exchange program at the University of Minnesota, and 9/11 happened. And he decided he wanted to go back to Jordan, and he wanted to correct this narrative that's going on in the Muslim world, because he saw that what Al-Qaeda and now what Daesh is doing is that they were providing role models. They were providing superheroes to young people. He went around to young people in Jordan and said, who are your heroes? Now, in the U.S., we tend to, when we ask young kids, they'll say, oh, Superman or Superwoman or Batman. We don't understand that kids in Jordan or in the Middle East, they don't have those kind of role models. So what Suleiman did was he created, you know, superheroes that were indigenous to the Middle East. He created comic books. He created animation. He created, and now they've become one of the most popular, most read, you know, comic books in the Middle East. And it's because it's providing young people with hope and positive role models.
We'll talk more about that after a short break with Haroon Ullah. And take your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Islam scholar Haroon Ullah is with us. He's a senior advisor at the State Department, working with Secretary Kerry on what's called public diplomacy, countering the narrative from extremist groups like the so-called Islamic State. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. How do you think the United States and its allies can counter this narrative that is helping to recruit young people from around the world to join the Islamic State's cause? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Haroon, here's an email from Rob who says, refusal by the administration to name the ISIS terrorists as Islamic or Muslims gives the appearance that this is not in any way religious, yet we know that 21 Christians were lined up and executed on a beach. Rob says, how can it not be at least in some way related to religion when people who follow Islam kill those who follow Christianity. Rob, thank you for the email. And you talked about this before, Haroon, but I'd like to hear from you again.
No, and thanks to Rob for the email. It's a good point. Look, our goal, I think, in a lot of ways is that violent extremism is a broader trend. We don't want to play into their narrative. Absolutely, there's violent extremists that are Muslim. There's a violent extremism strand that is part of Islam that you know we're trying to fight against. But by calling them Islamic extremists, that gives them legitimacy of religion. That's exactly what they want. And you know, part of it is that we want to call them for what they are. They are violent extremists. They are criminals. They are barbaric. And you know, but calling them Islamic extremists gives them that legitimacy. And so we don't want to play into that narrative, obviously, because not all Muslims are terrorists. And we want to sort of think about this broadly. We want to sort of undercut them in a way, I think, that's effective. And that we're trying to also get partners on board. To be successful at this, we have to get the Muslim world. We have to get governments in the region to take a leadership on this. And this is what they're doing now in Jordan and UAE and other places, because on some levels, they have to take a leadership to sort of crack down on this. And they're on the front lines of fighting against this.
You know, and to answer Rob's point about, you know, Christians are being killed by the so-called Islamic State, but so are Muslims. I mean, death on all religious fronts,
yes,
right?
There are death on all religious fronts. And in fact, Muslims are the most number of victims, right? So in terms of those that are getting targeted. And you know, so I absolutely agree that this is, you know, there's violent extremists. These are Muslims that are so-called Muslims that are trying to sort of, you know, they're using sort of a phony, and they're taking a very, like, you know, extreme strand of Islam to define them. But the core of it, they're criminals. And when you look at them, none of these people are well-versed in religion. Oftentimes, they're using religion as a cloak. They're using it as sort of a cape because they know that that's something in which it's an incentive for which they can recruit people.
Maybe we should call them the phony Islamic State.
Yeah.
Instead of the so-called self-styled
exactly.
Daesh and so forth. I have a really basic question that Rob's email raises in my mind. So thank you, Rob, for that. You know, in Iraq, when we talked about just how things started to really crumble and fall apart. And we talked about a Shia-Sunni split and how we called it sectarian violence. And there was a lot of explanation, including on our show, of what this was all about. Are there divides within the so-called Islamic State? I mean, is it Sunni against Shia? Can you just explain the brand of Islam that the leaders of this movement adhere to?
Yeah, I think the core of it, and this is a part brought up earlier about from the question on Iraq, is that the turmoil in Iraq, there was a split, and so Sunnis saw themselves as being the vanguard of quote unquote the Sunnis in the region, because they thought, look, there's a Shia crescent that's being created. You know, Iran's more powerful. There's these Shia militias in Iraq. The Shia community now were sort of empowered. So Daesh, these criminals say, look, we could be that opposition in this sort of Sunni awakening. And so oftentimes they said, we are defending the Sunnis. We are the ones that can defend the Sunnis. So they were able to take on that mantle. And they able to sort of push themselves and sort of – that's what they're trying to make the case. We're the ones defending Sunnis. And now people on the ground realize they're not necessarily the ones doing that, but they're able to brand themselves that.
And that's why Iran is getting involved, because Iran is Shia?
That's right. Iran is Shia, and they're supporting the sort of Shia militias, and oftentimes they see them also as a threat, right? So they see them as sort of that they don't want the rise of Daesh any more than we do.
All right, let's take another call, and this is Frank in Bedford. Hi, Frank, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. You briefly alluded to my comment. The 2003 invasion of Iraq has been called the worst foreign policy mistake the U.S. ever made. Saddam Hussein was a terrible person, but he was keeping the lid on there. None of this was going on. And when the Ba'athist Party was forced out, they disbanded the army. That's who ISIS is today. So in a sense, we can look at ISIS as brought to the world by George W. Bush and his policies. Anyway, that's my comment. My question is, Twitter and Facebook are the primary social media that the ISIS people, or Darvish, as Haroon calls them, are getting their message from. Why doesn't Facebook and why doesn't Twitter, why don't these companies shut down their communications? The Twitter and Facebook, they're American companies. Just get them off the air. Every time something comes in, intercept the messages from these folks and get it off?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Haroon.
Yeah, Frank, and thank you. And you know, as you student of history, you're very right. We have to understand context and all of this. And so I think part of it is sort of looking back at, you're right, very right, that the Baathists, that a lot of these people that are some of their frontline fighters come from the sort of old guard, but they're just changing. It's almost like they're changing their uniform every few years. And that's what Daesh is today. That's why I think of them as criminals. These are extremists at the core. You know, on your point, you're very right. And I think a lot of the American tech companies, they are doing that. Facebook, they have these 24/7 teams, and Twitter's, you know, they don't want them on their platforms because they recognize the sort of damage that is to their brand, and they don't want these users. The issue is that, you know, on these platforms, as you and I understand, it's very difficult. You take somebody off, they change, and they come under a different account. It's like whack-a-mole. So what happens is you shut them down on one account. They'll make up another fake account, and they come back on. You shut them down there. They come back on another fake account. So it's really a lot of whack-a-mole, and they're trying to sort of take them off. The problem is that a lot of also the speech you know, on Facebook and Twitter is that it comes up to the line of bordering on hate speech but doesn't cross it. So, for example, they're
unless you know what to look for.
Unless you know what to look for. A lot of it's subtle, coded language. A lot of it's, you know, and so Facebook and Twitter have very stringent denial of service laws and sort of agreements when you sign up. So they're using that to take and remove a lot of content. But a lot of things kind of sneak by because just the volume of content that's coming off, something like 500 million tweets a day. And so you can imagine going through all of those and seeing all this coded language, it's difficult. But you're right. And we're trying to work, you know, the tech companies, I think, are trying to work among themselves to sort of deal with this in a much more concentrated way because they recognize this is a damage to their brand if they continue to let them be on there.
Wow. Well, Frank, it's a great question. And I hear you on the volume. I mean, it's ginormous. On the other hand, there must be algorithms that people can employ that, you know, look for certain keywords and go, aha, that one's a problem.
Yeah, and I give credit to the companies. You know, they do have dedicated teams working around this 24/7. You know, oftentimes users will spot content and say, hey, why is that on there? Why is this flag on there? Why is there some content that's supporting ISIS? So oftentimes it's user complaints and they'll remove that pretty quickly. They have a good process. You know, my thinking on this is that, you know, we have to continue to do that, taking down content, what I think of as sort of denial service. But even more important is doubling down on the counter narrative speech, because you can take down content, but that's just saying no. We have to continue to, you know, and I hear this time and time from young people in the region. They say, don't just tell us what you're against, tell us what you're for. And so giving them the positive role models, giving them those testimonials, showing them how young people have succeeded against all the odds, you know, finding the young Malalas of the Middle East, somebody who I worked with very closely when I was in Pakistan, you know, how do we sort of amplify those stories? You know, this is International Women's Day just passed a few days ago. International Women's Week is this week. How do we highlight the stories of young women, inspiring women from the region that are doing things against all odds in their communities? I think that's part of it because that gives hope to young people and that will always outshine whatever Daesh is trying to put out there.
What if there isn't a lot of positivity in a particular neighborhood, community, whether it's in Western Europe or the United States or Pakistan or wherever? You know, I hear you on trying to highlight positive alternatives. Yes, it's not enough to say no. But what if you're kind of scrambling to find those positive alternatives? Do you create them? I mean, that's hard to do.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. You know, they're there, though. You know, I think if you look in communities, you'll find oftentimes, you know, as difficult as things are, you'll find young people that, you know, and I've always been amazed at this. I've spent almost 15 years in the Middle East, 10 years in South Asia, and I'm time and time again in even some of the difficult, hardest places, you'll find young people working around the system against all odds, you know, being very entrepreneurial, showing sort of innovative, if you just give them, you know, whether it's seed funding, whether you just give them a chance. And so, yes, in some of those communities, even in Western Europe, things seem pretty dire. But, you know, a lot of the community building that needs to take place is slow. It takes time. But they really need those positive role models. I go back to Solomon in Jordan. They need superheroes. They need superheroes. They need people to look up to, that even if those people are visions of what the future might look like, because that's what gives young people hope. And that's what Daesh, ISIL, Al-Qaeda, they've done. They've given their version of role models and superheroes.
And hope.
And hope.
Come to this great place.
They're
saying,
come to this great place. We will take care of all your grievances. We have this Club Med. And it's very important, yes, as difficult things are in the Middle East and South Asia, but what is that alternative narrative? You know, even if it's realistic, but it has to be a vision for the future.
Well, and again, mentioning the young man from Jordan who studied here for a while and then went back to Jordan and made positive change. Is one thing that you're looking at, Haroon, bringing more college-age students from the Muslim world over here to study so that there's some sort of cross-fertilization so that they understand that Americans aren't all, you know, terrible people?
Absolutely. I think
because that's tricky.
Because
then you have visa issues and
it's tricky, but I just think it's some of the best work that we do. It's some of the best work that can be done, this people-to-people exchange. You know, I myself was a Fulbrighter, and I went abroad to live in Morocco for 2 years. You know, the sort of exchange programs that bring young people here, oftentimes even to the area, and Plymouth State has a great program where they bring – I have seen it myself. This literally changes people's lives. They come here for 3 weeks, and they meet people of different religious backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. They're amazed. I mean, you know,
just
what they –
Just 3 weeks. That's not very long.
It's not long, but it's amazing what they learn in that period of time, oftentimes on some of these exchanges. You know, they see things on TV, but it's when they come here and they see our institutions, they see the communities, they see sort of the freedom to sort of debate things, even if they come here for college. I mean, I think that's one of the great American values and sort of one of the great traditions we have here. So I think, you know, having exchanges is so key because, again, those builds the relationships over the long term. Oftentimes, I can tell you how many people that have come on those 3 week exchanges, 10 years later, 15 years later, they become ministers in their countries. They become future ambassadors. They become even future prime ministers. And they will think back to their experience, both as young people. And we also have military officers that come here from different countries. Go to our different Fort Bragg or Fort Leavenworth, and they do exchanges. So I just think that people-to-people build relationships. And oftentimes, that's the best anecdote over the long term.
Well, Frank, again, thanks for that call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. As we talk about getting messages out there in social media, you can join us as well. And the number, 1-800-892-6477. Haroon, I want to go back to something that – a point you made a couple times this hour, that, yes, it isn't enough for the U.S. State Department or the Obama administration to say, hey – disaffected youth, don't do this. Obviously, you need to present positive alternatives. And you said those alternatives need to be presented by other parties, not the U.S. government and that official channel. You often hear American officials say Muslim leaders, especially religious leaders, need to counter this violent narrative with one of peace. You know, you hear people say Muslims need to step up. How do you feel about that? I mean, you know, let's say I'm Muslim. How do I interpret that? I mean, the 1.5 billion Muslims who abhor what ISIS is doing in their name, how do you feel about that? You need to step it up.
Well, I think that, you know, the idea is that, look, we're all in this together, but there's a role for a lot of faith-based leaders, Muslim leaders, to continue stepping up, to be out there on the front lines because they have the microphone. They have the legitimacy within audiences, and they have to keep on consistently, you know, hammering that message of hope, of sort of cutting the rhetoric of Daesh, of cutting painting a very different picture of what's going on, you know, making young people feel part of their communities. So I think more needs to continue to be done. I mean, we've seen great examples of what happened in Norway where there is young people forming around a synagogue. You find these great examples in Australia where they had the hashtag ride with us after that tragedy. They said, look, we're all in this together. You have a great example of here in Boston with Boston Strong after the tragedy. That's about communities coming together. And if you looked in all of those instances, you had a lot of faith-based leaders on the front lines. It's because they have legitimacy. They speak to some of those targeted audiences that we're most interested in, where there's disaffected youth. And they have to continue doing that. And there is more to be done. You know, they have done a lot. But, you know, oftentimes the silent majority is silent. You know, it's the extremes that excite people. It's the extremes that become very active on the fringes. And we even know this in political campaigns and here in domestic politics. How do you motivate that what I call silent majority that's oftentimes passive? They also have to have a passion to sort of go out there for their moderate views. It's on those leaders many times to sort of mobilize, energize, and inspire.
Moderation, though, isn't as exciting as passion, including violent passion, and moderation doesn't get to carry a big gun and, you know, play a video game in real life. So
exactly. And that's why I mentioned the part about superheroes, the part about painting a positive vision for the future. We need more young Malalas. We need more young Soleimans. We need people that are doing things against all odds, that are creating and telling their stories. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's, to me, that's one of the key things. I mean, you referenced my book, The Bargain from the Bazaar. That's what I was trying to do in The Bargain from the Bazaar, is tell the story of this family that was dealing with extremism, and the young parents, they're fighting against all odds, but they decided to tell their story of what happened and how they dealt with one of their children. You can imagine a family gets torn apart when they're dealing with extremism. So we need more positive role models.
Well, Haroon, just to wrap up, you mentioned at the outset that Daesh, ISIS, whatever you want to call it, is putting out 60,000-plus pieces of social media a day. You know, you've probably watched all the horrible videos that many of us don't want to watch.
Don't watch them.
Yeah, I will not. Trust me. But I just wonder, I mean, just personally, how do you wake up in the morning and just start thinking about this stuff every day and not get completely paranoid or depressed and just, you know, want to throw your hands up?
It's tough at times, but, you know, I oftentimes, you know, the work is so important. I've seen the difference it can make with young people. When I go abroad to the Middle East and South Asia, I see these young people talking to me. I see the hopes that they're sort of fighting for a very different future. That's what keeps me going. And, you know, I remember this quote by Allama Iqbal, sort of famous poet in South Asia. He says, "Don't get frightened by the furious, violent winds, O eagle. They only blow to make you fly higher." And I think that's all of what we need. All of us need to do that, Laura. All of us together in the communities here internationally, we have to fly higher together, because that's the vision for the future.
Okay. Well, Haroon, that was great to meet you, and good luck tonight at your talk. More information on that at nhpr.org.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kinoy.